Good day, good night, and welcome to World Cup Today. One half of the quarterfinals is already in the books. Two more games later today, Dwayne. Yesterday, France-Uruguay was the first game, and Brazil-Belgium. First of all, before we get into details of the games, Dwayne, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm sitting here waiting for the England game, wearing a Fenerbahce jersey that I found yesterday for $5 at a little thrift store in town. So
that's a good find. That's always fun.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell anyone where this is because there's a whole bunch more, and you know I'm going to wait till I get paid, and I might go back and get a few more. I'm going to grab one for Kevin there too because I know he likes to wear the jerseys during the strip. But if you could go to every thrift store in Toronto, support your local businesses, and you'll eventually find this place that has like 19 different varieties of soccer jerseys available for like $5, $6, $10 top end. Like there's a Bayern Munich jersey there for about $10, $12. So yeah.
Well, that was pretty good. That's pretty good. Now the games yesterday. Wow, those were fun games. That, you know, no tomorrow football sometimes brings you moments where teams are conservative, teams are not trying to go forward. What we saw yesterday in two different occasions, I'm not going to call them tactical masterclass, and I'm not going to say Roberto Martinez outmanaged Tite and that Didier Deschamps outmanaged what's his face with Lopez with Uruguay.
Yeah.
But wow, France, the way they were able to just get a few goals, get things started. It's never easy against Uruguay, right? Uruguay is not the type of team where you ever get into a sense of control or a sense of having a grasp on the game. It's always last-ditch efforts. It's always nervy. But France, 2, Uruguay, 0.
Yeah, and look, I think when the lineups came out and it was clear that the Cavani injury was not going to allow him to participate in this game, that might have been the writing on the wall. I mean, obviously, there's other talent there. We really like that defensive pairing, the Atleti defensive pairing at the back. Suarez, on his day, can be one of the world's greatest strikers. But without Cavani, who had been their talisman throughout this tournament, I think maybe they were kind of done off the get-go. But you mentioned the scamps and France and sort of throughout this tournament, I keep seeing these headlines like France wins ugly. Oh, France wasn't impressive. Oh, ugh, France, but they won again. But the key word in all this is win. They keep winning. And to me, there's something ominous about that. When I see a team, especially a team of the quality of France that is figuring out how to win, even though they haven't really fired on all cylinders from both sides of the game on any one of their games during this tournament, I think, yeah, they're the favorite. Like, we picked them as a favorite going in, so I'm not just tipping my own hat, but I think the longer this goes and the deeper this goes, I mean, I don't think anyone can objectively look at this now and not think France is the favorite of the six teams remaining in this tournament. Now, that said, this has been a tournament where favorites are falling. So yeah. Maybe that's not a position they want to be.
No, and the matchup, this salivating matchup of the first semifinal that we know, France versus Belgium. This is what? Like, who writes this stuff, right? The battle of the Francophonie. The eternal rivals, the neighbors that sometimes loves each other, sometimes hate each other. This is just beautiful. This is what it's all about. Yes, it's a European tournament at this point. And that's one thing that I've been talking about for 3 weeks. Let's not forget, it's hard. I don't think it has ever been done. If I go back, did Brazil ever win a World Cup in European soil?
No, right? It was the first – when Germany won in Brazil, it was the first time a European team had won it in South America, and vice versa also applies at this particular time. So, no, it hasn't happened. I mean, in fact, if you look at the history of World Cup winners, 75% of them have come from four countries, right? So what's nice about this World Cup is that those four countries are all out. In one case, they didn't even make it in Italy. But that means that we're going to have – a winner from that 25%, worst case scenario, if you like new things, and that would be France, or you're going to get more England. Sorry, I forgot, because even I wasn't old enough to be around then.
Belgium won it, never won it.
Right? Winners, but they, so it's going to be new other than that. But, yeah, it's fun times there. No, yeah, the European thing, there's a lot of talk about that, and it does reflect – something. There is something to that. It's not just coincidence. It's not just geography. It reflects the amount of money in the game in
infrastructure.
Europe. And well, it's one.
Sorry, Dwayne, I was going to say, you say money, I say infrastructure. It's the same thing at the end of the day, but it's how you spend your money, right? It's how the money's been funneled on to the team and how this money being spent, and not just at a national team level. At a national team level, it's almost the result of what the club local academies do at a bigger scale, and how the entire quote-unquote pyramid of player development is able to identify player, funnel them through, get them developed at the right time, the right place, and when they are, use them the way they did. But you're right, it's about the difference of money invested in the sport itself. If you look at Uruguay, which is, yes, has a lot of history, 2 Olympic championship before the World Cup existed, 2 World Cups, so that's why they have 4 stars. You should only have 2, but anyways, you see the difference, though. Uruguay is not a country where infrastructures and money is funneled into sports, never mind just football, the way it is in Europe. And you do see a big difference. And for them to made it to the round of 16 and to the quarterfinals, it is an achievement into itself. And we have some time to take a step back and look at teams like Germany. You know, Germany spent so much money and they still don't even get out of the group. Adidas must still be crying for that aspect of a few weeks ago. And that tells you a lot, that even football powers outside of Europe, hard to keep up with Europe now.
Yeah, well, for sure. You say the club game, and I mean, that's not mince words here. The club game is 90% of what makes a national team. And it's why whenever I hear people, particularly in this part of the world, that are rallying against, you know, sack the CSA or reform the USSF or what have you, yeah, there's elements that need to change there. But really, when it comes right down to it, what especially in this country, the biggest thing missing, this country being Canada where we record this, is the club infrastructure isn't there. We don't have the ability to produce. Flash to Europe to go back to the World Cup, obviously that's what they have. That's how they rely on things. I mean, outside of a few exceptions, the Germans made some structural changes to sort of channel their players in a different way and made some decisions in the Bundesliga, which have affected things as well. You look at France has some national team central program, which is really, especially on the women's side, affected things. And I think you see sort of the influence of the federations of the women's side more than the men's side, because the club games are so vastly different. But you look at a country like, say, Croatia right now. Croatia, it's a shambles internally. Like, the Croatian Football Association makes the CSA look like a gold star, you know, top Fortune 500 company, really, in terms of how it's run. It's just chaos and corruption. But, yet, here they are, perhaps, you know, maybe the second best, if not the best team in this tournament right now, and staring at a trip to the final. And why is that? It's because they have club structure there, which is also a bit chaotic, but it's also club structure that has a financial, you know, incentive to produce players and to produce players at a highest level and move them on to bigger leagues, which can make them even better, right? That's how the system works. And, you know, I'm preaching to the choir to a lot of the listeners, but some of them might be newer, but that sort of think more international first, but that's the case. The UEFA Champions League is probably the bigger influence in terms of why Europe is starting to pull away from the rest of the world than anything done on the international level. There's produces so much money and produces so much incentive for teams to produce players and get into that big lottery, basically. That allows to you know, that fuels them, their domestic leagues moving forward. And that's why you see Europe doing so, so well. And it's why it's, you know, when you're talking to move it back here to finish the thought, it's why in Canada, when everyone's screaming about sacking the CSA and doing all these grassroots reform, all I say is, well, the CSA is doing fine because they're allowing this Canadian Premier League to go forward. And that's what's going to not fix it, because we're not ever going to be at the European level, not in my lifetime anyway, but at least make us respectable.
No, yeah, and it is fascinating, too, when I'll go back to France example, too. Sometimes it's a game of very slim margins, right? And as much as we think that France played defensively very well, even though it's hard to play against Uruguay because they do come at you in a different way, it is more of a, I don't want to say improvisation on the field, but it's harder to anticipate a move if you don't know what this person is going to do. And put this with 11 players, you got yourself the type of football that Uruguay plays. And I thought that France was very smart in the way they were playing, trying to defend correctly. Sometimes it's last-ditch efforts, but they had players there at the right time. Umtiti, I just have the image of a bicycle kick clearance, just because he wanted to clear the ball as soon as possible from the box to eliminate any potential risk. And of course, Hugo Lloris' left-hand save was magnificent. Well, I think it was right-hand. Anyways, his one-hand save was magnificent. And for two goalkeepers yesterday, Dwayne, two goalkeepers that were criticized a bit in this tournament, and in the past year or so, Hugo Lloris and Thibaut Courtois had maybe the games of their lives.
No, for sure. Look, a lot of people are criticizing France's performance in that game, but I didn't really view it that way. As I said, I think they're playing a very effective game, and they're playing the game that, to me, translates the most moving forward and is the most likely to have them win, which is what I said at the start of the tournament. So, and part of the reason I said that at the start of the tournament, and I think a lot of people said it, is because they looked at the draw that they potentially would have, and that was, you know, France has gone chalk. So we are looking at the same line that we expected them to go to, and it all looked winnable up into this game. And the reason we thought the next game wouldn't be winnable or might not be winnable is because we chalked it to another team that is now out. So who is the favorite in that game, Belgium versus France? I'm not sure, because I look at Belgium and I still – it's like Spain in 2010 when it comes to Belgium, I think, is that you look at the talent and you go, yeah, they're there. But then you go, they've never done it before. And until they do it, there's going to be a reluctance to sort of fully buy in. I would say the same thing about Croatia. The talent's on the paper, but until you see it consistently over, you know, the sprint, a seven-game sprint to a World Cup championship, you don't really necessarily believe it can happen until you see it happen. But as we've seen it happen, we saw it happen in France, so that maybe puts another little bit of a caveat on there. But now you look at this generation of players, an entire generation away from Zidane and the boys back in 1998, and a chance to win it away from home. This really would solidify if France could get this done. France, as right now, they're on that tier just below the elites, the great nations of the game. They're just below that. And if they win this second World Cup, then maybe they join them.
Let's move to Brazil, Belgium. And I have to say, before the tournament, a lot of fans of Belgium were worried, or maybe I should say concerned, about Roberto Martinez and how his tenure would actually look like at the World Cup. And when you're a team like Belgium, where it's hard to have meaningful game against tough opponents during the regular lead up to a World Cup, you play in a qualification process that you play a team below you in the rankings, and friendlies are friendlies. You don't get the same intensity and the same will to win, basically, just because of, well, human will human. And if it's not on the line, guess what? We're not going to try to do the third and fourth effort like it is when it's all on the line. Even though they struggle against Japan, that three-goal comeback for a win, I think, gave them a boost of confidence. And they did the one thing Brazil had not faced this World Cup yet, and that's trailing in a game. And Brazil did not know how to handle that. Tite was not able to adjust in the first half, where it was important. They did in the second. They got the late goal. They got some great chances in the second half after adjustment tactically by Tite. But in the first half, Roberto Martinez shuffling his deck, Lukaku on the right flank, four-man back line instead of three, one more person in the midfield, finding space for De Bruyne. You're able to find De Bruyne. De Bruyne with a laser shot, and there's an own goal, and Belgium is a 2-0 advantage going into the break. That was a shock.
No, for sure. I mean, everyone, again, what I just said a minute ago is that until you see Belgium do it, you're reluctant to think that they can. You look at that talent, and there is a strong argument to be made that player for player, on paper, Belgium is the most talented team in the world right now. And they have been for a while. And it's immensely talented across the board. Every position is strong for Belgium. Arguably, they're stronger than Brazil in terms of player for player, and we saw that play out. And now, look, a lot of people would like to point out, or will point out, or I've been seeing on social media anyway, this concept that Brazil vastly outplayed Belgium.
No.
I think maybe what people are thinking of is the last 20 or 30 minutes of that game, which is fine, but you've got to put score effect into play at that point. They're protecting a two-goal lead for most of that. And when you're protecting a two-goal lead, especially against a team like Brazil, you're going to low block, you're going to absorb the pressure, teams can effectively absorb a low block now. And outside of the goal, and there was one other play that sort of grazed the top of a crossbar, Brazil really didn't get much penetration. And that's you know, something to be said about that. And we'll talk about Brazil a bit more first, but let's focus on the winners. I thought it was a masterful performance by the Belgians, and it sets up an incredibly fascinating game in that semifinals, not just for geopolitical reasons. And there's lots of reasons to be interested in that game for that. They're neighbors. They both speak the same language. Well, half of Belgium does anyway. And, you know, there's a lot of history there. Hell, I mean, you know, there's a lot of history there between Belgium and France. So that's,
exactly.
Leave it at that. And yeah, it's because that's a fascinating thing there. But just stylistically too, it's like who's going to crack first. France wants to play kind of a similar game. They like to get the speed out wide and to break them down after playing a solid sort of ugly game to chip it down. What's Belgium going to do? It's a fascinating tactical game as well.
It will be a very fascinating tactical game. But again, the first half of Belgium, the way that Roberto Martinez was able to switch it up. Belgium got the lucky break, and Belgium was able to get the second goal and to shock Brazil and to put Brazil into a different state of pretty much football, where they had to play from behind and trying to push forward. And you were able to see players like Fernandinho being a bit exposed in the first half by Belgium because of their speed, because of their awareness on the pitch. So that was fascinating to me. All right, Dwayne can't hear me, so just give me a second. I'll make sure that he can hear me again. Okay, so Dwayne, you can hear me, so we'll just continue like this. For me, it's fascinating that Belgium was able to understand and to put a plan together to actually get a goal early. And you know what? That was probably the only way you can beat Brazil if you're Belgium, where position by position, it might be difficult, but you might have the advantage on a few, like De Bruyne and maybe one or two defenders. But Vertonghen and Vermaelen are not necessarily the best defenders in the world. Vermaelen basically can't get into Barcelona. But altogether, as a team, like Vincent Kompany mentioned a few days before, if Belgium plays as a team, they can beat Brazil. And they did.
Well, they did, yeah. And look, we talked about and they could beat France, too. Like, they're a fascinating team. I mean, it's a small nation, so you don't necessarily think that they could you even Belgium, Croatia, there's a final that we'd all, no one would have picked. That's not that unrealistic at this point. But
yeah,
exciting times. All right, I want to talk about Brazil, though.
Go ahead.
You have to. They're Brazil. This is three World Cups. You look at the last three World Cups, quarterfinals, 7-1, pardon me, 8-1's on the brain. Quarterfinals, 7-1, quarterfinals. That is historically bad for Brazil. Does that speak to a long-term trend? Is Brazil the Montreal Canadiens of world football now? Are they going to be talking about their, you know, pointing to past glories and, you know, black and white footage? That's the Leafs, sorry. Non-HD footage of championship runs moving forward? Or is...
I don't know.
Or is it... Is, yeah.
Well, for me, Brazil is a team that has to realize that the world has caught up in a way that one, two, or three superstars of attacking will not balance the lack of great goalkeeper and defenders. And if you could just go back to the history of Brazil, outside of Julio Cesar, how many household name goalkeeper can you name from Brazil? How many household name from outside of the starting back line and maybe a few? How many top-level, world-class defenders does Brazil produce? We all know Thiago Alves. We all know Dani Alves. But what happened when those guys are injured? Exactly.
Marcelo, but yeah.
Outside of that, exactly. You got four or five names that are world-class. And then kids, all Brazilian kids want to be Ronaldo, the fat one, not the Cristiano one. And all kids want to be Neymar. Maybe not anymore. But before a few weeks ago, everyone wanted to be Neymar. So I think there's something to it that defending and playing the famous cliche without the ball has to be worked on maybe a bit more if you're Brazil.
Perhaps, yeah. You're probably not wrong. I'll get another interpretation for you too, though. I mean, it's been a long time since Samba football was a thing. Maybe 1970, right? So we're predating our lives. So that's not really a thing anymore. But the other thing about Brazil that I think, they don't have an identity anymore. The identity we have for Brazil is nostalgic. For nostalgia, that's their identity, right? Like, we think about their them stylistically, comparing them to Brazil teams of the past. And even when they won in 2002, it was very pragmatic. And 2002 has been a while now. Like, I mean, let's do the math here, folks. Makes us feel old when we do, but it's been a while. So really, when you look at Brazil, I think maybe they need to find that identity again. Because right now what they're doing, as you just identified, is they're trying to have it both ways. They're trying to play kind of like, oh, we're Brazil, and we're going to be creative, and we're going to be offensive, and we're going to dictate terms in our own hand. But they're doing that with modern players and modern tactics, and they don't have the players to play those. They don't have – it's the same problem that Argentina had, right, just a little bit more exaggerated in Argentina's case. So they just don't have that ability to play a full game anymore. And you know, you look at the – I don't know if any team can. I don't know if, tactically speaking, if the tactics have evolved to the point that you can't, you know, go against the trends. I don't know, because sports in the modern world has become very copycat. And, you know, 10 years ago, every team in the world was trying to play possession-based football. And God help nations like smaller nations that tried to do this because they just didn't have the players to do it. Now every country in the world is trying to play this block and attack counter game. So very few try and buck that trend. And if you do try and buck that trend, you either stand out or you get your head chopped off by critics because they go, well, why are you playing that way when the rest of the world is playing this way? And certainly there's probably conversations like that going on in Spain right now, and Barcelona, for that matter, for the Champions League failings. So it's really kind of a catch-22, but I do think that Brazil needs to find that identity again and find out what makes them Brazil. They produce so much immense talent that they should be able to find a way to find the players that fit those positions. Are they indeed all playing, you know, 10s and 9s? I don't know. Maybe. But if that's the case, then they need to address that somewhere. And there's herein where we go back to our first conversation of this show and talk about infrastructure and just organization. And this is where South America is failing. They for years have had chaos in their federations, and lots of, not even chaos, corruption too. And then on their club levels, they also have chaos and corruption and constant selling. So these players aren't sticking around for very long. They're going to Europe. They're diversed all over the world. That makes it very difficult for them to come together and find any kind of identity or union as the national team. Whereas the European teams often will be playing primarily in, especially the big European teams, primarily are playing either in their domestic league or one of the big four domestic leagues. So they all know each other. They're all, if not in the same team, at least sort of familiar with each other and hang out with each other. There's a familiarity there immediately, right? That just doesn't exist in South America. And I think that, especially with Argentina, but I see Argentina and Brazil as the same problem, just slightly more exaggerated, as I said, on the one side. And it's chaos. It's like they're throwing stuff against a wall and seeing what happens, and nothing's happening.
And I think there's something to say about what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, too. As much as we want to say about Brazil, economically speaking, even though the Brazilian Football Federation might be the one entity in the entire government or social structure that is the best funded, doesn't mean that it's well-funded or funded enough or funded correctly or funded transparently. And I think that has something to do with it too. Just the lack of patience sometimes with the Brazilian national team and the federation. And you mentioned lack of identity. The lack of plan going forward, I believe, can be something there too. Is there a plan for 4 years, 8 years? Well, it's good. So I think there's a lot to say about this. When you have like players like Polino, who plays in damn China, how do you want to change that level and come back national team and be effective? Yeah, so no, there's a lot of questions arising with this defeat from Brazil. Even though it was just by one goal, I think that defeat is more than just a 2-1 win versus Belgium. It's a bit of a defeat when you over-rely on a few pieces. What was the goal coming from the midfield, right? Where were the Ronaldinho, the attacking midfielder of his era? You have like the Coutinhos. You had players with chances, but they were not clinical enough. the moment got to them at the second. Cucino had the tie-in goal on his left foot, and he put it in the corner of the stadium. So, yeah, they had their chances. So it's not like they literally were outplayed at that moment. They were able when you know you're not coming back from this, when it's a no tomorrow game and there's 20 minutes left, you just throw everything forward. But at that moment, in my mind, that game was already lost because of Belgium's performance. But anyways, it is interesting to see what happens from now, because Tite has been touted as an amazing tactician, great manager, changed everything in Brazil. Well, I guess he didn't change everything because they still haven't won it since 2002.
Yeah. Look, I think there's a couple ways that you can evaluate teams that I like to do. Your 6 and your 6, your 10 and your 9. For those that aren't familiar with the numbers, that's your defensive midfielder, your attacking midfielder, and your center forward, right? You can look at those three players in a real basic kind of, you know, simple way and sort of evaluate them, compare their talents and their abilities to the teams that you're trying to compare them to with. And when you look at Brazil, outside of Neymar, the 9, is their 6 and their 10 up to the snuff of the other great teams in this tournament? I'm not sure.
I'll say no.
Middling in that way.
There's no other De Bruyne. De Bruyne might be the best midfielder in the planet right now, but hands down. I won't go as far as saying the best player, because Ronaldo and Messi and whatever. But De Bruyne, as a midfielder, hands down the smartest and the best midfielder in the world right now.
Well, Hazard has something to say about that, and Modric. So there you go, right? So that these are guys aren't Brazilian, which is exactly what we're saying. So the other, just to change path a little bit too, if you want to really evaluate and go back to the South American versus European thing, one of the ways that I like to also evaluate as someone who follows women's football pretty closely, the strength of the women's football program in these countries can give you a good indication, a good insight into exactly what's happening at the highest levels. Because the club game and sort of just pure skills and like producing players and like a mass level can hide a lot of cracks in your system, but you can't hide a lot of cracks in your women's system if the infrastructure isn't there, because the club game doesn't exist to back it up. And you look at South American women's football and it is in shambles. It is terrible outside of Brazil, which again, that's like, we just produce a lot of players. So if some of them figure it out,
so it's they win despite of their pyramid and development system and not because of.
Yeah. You look at the rest of South America, nothing there. There's no support. There's no organization. Argentina doesn't even play games. The Argentina women's national team has played like 3 games in the last 4 years or something. It's embarrassing. It's ridiculous. It's shameful is what it is.
It's sexist and misogynist as well. And we're not going to get into a conversation here about this whole thing, but there's more of those happening in the world of soccer in South America than there is in other parts of the world. Let's call a spade a spade. The attitudes haven't changed there yet. And you see the result with the, like you mentioned, the women national team programs across South America, where, well, they are behind the times. And I guess it does make that the entire federations are behind the times.
And you know what, where does actually support women's football and where you're seeing a real boom at it is sort of those North European countries. And look how well they're doing in this World Cup. Sweden's going to play today. Denmark went to the round of 16. Holland is struggling in the men's side, but they won the European Championship there and they have a direction. Germany is a perennial power on both sides of the game. England is finally trying to figure it out, right? The English are even doing this well on the women's side of the game, and there was a big resistance there, misogynistic resistance for a long time, but they're starting to figure it out. There really is a, you know, what's that? In a coal mine, canary in a coal mine.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was going to say there's a canary in a coal mine element of women's football. If you look at what's happening on the women's side, you can often see systemic problems on the men's side if you're willing to open your eyes and have a look at it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. All right. England, Sweden, Croatia, Russia. I'm nervous. I barely slept. I'm going to have to say, I need to get ready. I need to go there. I need to go where I'm going. I'm going to Brigham Lion to watch the Three Lions play against Sweden. And you know what, Dwayne? I might never go into an IKEA ever again. Who knows?
No, IKEA is wonderful. They great, make great. You get a little mac and cheese there for a dollar at an IKEA. You can spend a whole day there. I have spent a whole day there before in the past, and yeah, maybe not that again. But no, it's a nice little cafeteria up there. I will be, if anyone is in the Toronto area and listening to this before it goes, which probably won't happen, but if you are, I will be at Opera Bob's today, the Manchester City bar, which also serves as an England bar during the World Cup. I'm actually around the corner from a very famous England bar here, but the lineup probably started about a half hour ago, so no, that won't be happening today. The most famous England bar, real quickly before we go, I was talking to one of the staff there. I've only been once during the World Cup, Scallywags, I'm talking about. And so I was talking to the staff who knows me pretty well. And she said that that the lineup to get into the your Liverpool game, and was the same, they were anticipating the same for England knockout games, started at 5 in the morning. So that's kind of the craziness of how many England fans there are in the city I am in.
Yeah.
And yeah. I had someone on Twitter telling me that we shouldn't be fans of the team because of some, I don't know, history or something. I don't know. Anyway, it's weird. Cheer for who you want.
Yeah, cheer for who you want and enjoy this World Cup however you damn please to. There's no right or wrong answer. And if someone trying to tell you so, it's on them and not on you. And thank God I know owners of bars. Otherwise, I wouldn't get in because it's already late, like you were mentioning, as always. So let's wrap it up for today. As always, you can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute, myself at Kev Laramie. We'll be back tomorrow to review England, Sweden, Croatia, Russia, and talk about the world of the World Cup, which is not a lot of games left. Wayne, it's coming to an end soon.
Six games, right?
Yep.
Something. Two today, two more, four, five, six games. Six games, yeah. It's called Cooling's third place game, six.
63 down, six to go, and as always, until tomorrow, have a great soccer.